I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, The Morning Show with Greg Berg is next. Support for the morning show comes from Carthage College, where students can conduct NASA research, produce an original play, or join an in-house marketing agency as early as their freshman year. More information is available at carthage.edu. Before we get to today's interview, I want to mention something special that's coming up on tomorrow's program. Tomorrow marks the 150th anniversary to the day of the Great Chicago Fire. And tomorrow, in commemoration of that unhappy anniversary, we're going to be replaying an interview from 25 years ago to commemorate the 125th anniversary of the fire, an interview conducted by my predecessor on the morning show, longtime WGTD news director Bill Guy, who interviewed the author of one of the definitive accounts of that tragedy, a book called Smoldering City. You'll hear Bill Guy's interview with the author on tomorrow's morning show. I hope you'll make a special note of it. Again, we welcome you to the Friday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg, and I'm very, very pleased that we can spend most of the hour today talking about a great play called Betrayal by Harold Pinter. And with us in the studios of WGTD to talk about it are three people involved in the production that has just opened at Carthage College last weekend. Dr. Harold, Herschel Kruger, how did I call you Harold? I don't know. Herschel Kruger, who is professor of theater at Carthage and director of this production. And with him, two students at Carthage who have significant roles in this production. First of all, Caitlin Preuss, a junior double major in musical theater and directing, is co-director with Professor Kruger. And Natalie Lal is playing the lead role of Emma in this production. And this show also represents her senior thesis. She is a double major in theater performance and political science. And again, the production opened last weekend, but runs this coming weekend as well. Is it just this coming weekend?
Correct. This is our second weekend, and we are at 7:30 tonight, Friday and Saturday.
Very good. We welcome all of you to the morning show. Professor Kruger, I announced this as the first production of the theater department season. Am I correct about that?
That's correct, and it's the first production in more than a year and a half where we've had an outside audience. And we haven't been masked on stage, and we're really excited to be able to do that again. You know, last season we pushed on and we were masked and mic'd, but we were only allowed to have on campus staff, faculty, and students attend the productions, and 10% capacity. And the spring before was scrapped, so it's really exciting to be back. To see members of the community coming and joining us again, and it just makes you really grateful for what you have.
Right. So I should think there was a very special electricity in the air when this production opened last weekend. I mean, that very first performance.
Yeah, it was really nice, and just seeing some people I hadn't seen in a while, and you know, just, you know, we're still wearing masks indoors, but, you know, you recognize each other, you say hello, and you know, you see it in their eyes. So I think as much as we're happy to be on stage, people are really excited, really happy to be in the audience and to see theater again and to, you know, enjoy themselves.
Right. I don't think any of us who enjoy this kind of thing will ever take it for granted again, or one would certainly hope not. Explain a little bit about the choice to do this particular play, Harold Pinter's Betrayal. Is this something you chose?
Actually, it was something that Caitlin wrote a proposal for. We solicit proposals from our students each year, and some years it'll work, and some years it won't. But last year, two of the proposals made it into this year's season. And I was first exposed to Pinter when I moved to New York in the mid-80s to studying acting at the National Shakespeare Conservatory. And I was, like, doing scenes from, like, Neil Simon or Sam Shepard or David Mamet. And some of my friends started getting up, and they were doing scenes from Betrayal, and I was really fascinated by the language and the style of the writing. And over the years, I had worked on it as an actor. I had worked on it in scenes, but I had never directed a production. But it's also a script that's used as a required text from the directing book that I use for my directing class. So we've been doing it in class scene work for many years, but when Caitlin wrote the proposal and we were looking for something in that genre, it fit perfectly with the season.
So Caitlin Preuss, who is co-director, Professor Kruger made it very clear before we went on the air. She is not the assistant director, she is
correct,
the co-director. Caitlin Preuss, what prompted you to propose this as a possible production?
Yeah, I mean, just working on it in class, it was one of the only plays I've ever read that, like, really stuck with me afterwards. And so I thought it would be a really great fit for the main stage season, and I also thought it would be we're not post-pandemic, but it would be a good comeback after a year of masking and distancing and, you know, outside people not being able to come to our productions, just because of how human the story is. And it really does, when you watch the production, it really does take you out of, you know, what's going on outside of the theater doors. So I just really, really enjoyed the story, and I thought the small cast would be a good practice for a lot of our actors who are here right now, and that has proven to be true as well. So I was really excited when it was picked. I really didn't think it was going to be, because we worked on it in directing class and always had, and but I was like, it's worth a shot, because I liked it so much. So yeah, I was really pleased when it was put on the main stage. So
very good. I know this play was written in 1978, but from the sounds of it, it involves some innovation, particularly in the use of reverse chronology. Explain to our listeners what I'm talking about.
So scene one, where it opens the play, is almost the most present day. And scene nine, which is really the beginning in a linear fashion, is the end of the play. And what's interesting, I think, from an audience member's point of view is how much is revealed in scene one, but you can't put all the pieces together until you see everything else and you understand the history and you see where the revelations and the discoveries are made and when the betrayal comes to light. And it just makes for much more interesting storytelling.
Caitlin, since you proposed this, let's give you the assignment of describing the plot to us.
Yeah, so there are four actors who are in the production. And so the main characters that we see on stage are Emma, Jerry, and Robert. So Emma and Robert are married, and Jerry is Robert's oldest friend. Robert's best friend is kind of how they always title him. And then behind closed doors, Emma and Jerry are having an affair behind Robert's back. So throughout the play, in the backwards timeline fashion, we see, you know, Emma and Robert's marriage and how that manifests itself for those two characters, and then also Emma and Jerry's relationship, and you kind of see all of the characters deciding what they truly want out of these relationships with one another. And then our fourth actor is the waitress in a restaurant scene, who does a wonderful job. So it's really those three main characters that are in pretty much every scene. And so, yeah, it's basically just the unfolding backwards of those three people's relationships with one another.
We haven't yet talked to Natalie Lal, who is portraying the role of Emma. So she is the wife who is having this affair with the friend. And one of the things Caitlin said was that it's sometimes good to do a play that has a very small cast, because it presents a very particular kind of challenge to those who are in that small cast. And I'm sure you can attest to that firsthand about how challenging it is when you are in a cast of four versus a cast of 24.
Absolutely. I would actually say, I think for me, this has been one of the most delightful processes to work on for a show, because it's a small cast. And so you really get the time to develop relationships and connections with your scene partners. And I think that's the great joy of any actor, is getting to really have the time. And we have this hour and a half slot where the whole show is really an exploration of these characters and their relationships with one another. And you have so many scenes to develop that. And I think it's the mark of how well the show is written, that there are so many connections between the scenes and the characters. And because the show works backwards, you pick up on, oh, I see in this later scene, this topic of conversation comes up in an earlier scene that happens 6 years later. And so there are all these nuggets of information, and you get to use that. And because it's a small cast, it's the same people in every scene. So you just learn a lot about their background. There's a lot to work with as an actor. It's not like coming to a completely blank slate when you're in a big musical where you have to build your whole character's backstory, making up things. There's so much provided in the text. And with scene partners who are also doing really deep work on these characters, they just sort of come to life very naturally because of how intimate it is.
So in other words, a play that has a wider plethora of characters, there isn't time to spend on each one, and you have to create backstories because there's no time to give those extensively. But in a play like this of intimate proportions, so much is on the page, and that's a rich well from which for you to draw. Mm-hmm. But it also means you have a lot to do. You have a lot of lines to learn, right?
Yes, actually, this show, for some reason, was one of the hardest shows for me to memorize. And I think it's because it's such realistic dialogue. Pinter is known for the famous Pinter pause. Throughout his scripts, he has lots of pauses and silences written, because that's the way we speak. Sometimes we're in these really big, heightened emotional moments of our lives. We don't know what to say. And Pinter picks up on that. But it does make it very challenging to learn, because our directors really helped us to be cognizant of those pauses, because they help when we just would plow through these pauses. Something about the flow of the scene just was off. That's not what the playwright's intention was for the scene. So being cognizant of the very specific text that was written and of these pauses was hard to memorize, because it sounds a lot like normal speech. But the joy is that when you get it, it sounds really good, and it just clicks.
Fantastic. For those of you just joining us, we're talking about the play Betrayal by Harold Pinter, which opened this past weekend at Carthage College and runs for more performances this weekend beginning tonight. We have with us in the studio Natalie Lal, who is playing the role of Emma, Caitlin Preuss, who is co-director with Dr. Herschel Kruger. And again, these performances are available to you tomorrow and Friday and Saturday.
Correct.
Natalie, I said something to you before we went on the air about must be interesting to play a character. I don't remember what adjective I used, but But this is someone who is engaged in an affair, and of course it's a two-way street. It's not like this affair is her fault, but I mean, nevertheless, this is a person who is behaving in a way that most of us would not approve. And of course, that's the heart and soul of the story. And of course, in some ways, we can get into this if you like, the betrayal kind of goes both ways. She not only is betraying her father, her husband with this affair, but ultimately is betraying the man who with whom she's having the affair. What's it like for you to do a character like that, that at least to some extent is someone that you might not admire, at least at first glance?
Mm-hmm. I'd say at first, upon approaching Emma, the primary challenge was the age. At her oldest, I believe she's 38, and I'm 21. So that was the first challenge of, I am not in a marriage. I don't know what it would be like based on my own life experience, what could cause someone to have an affair after being married for already several years and in a committed relationship. So that was the first challenge, was just sort of getting into the world. But the other challenge, I would actually say it wasn't a challenge to play someone whose moral choices probably wouldn't align with my own choices in my own life. Because I think as the actor, it's not my job to judge my character. And when I'm doing this character work and I'm going into who is she, why is she making the choices that she's making, what does she want, it's so easy to see why she engages in this affair. When I explore her headspace, when I'm in there and thinking about her marriage with Robert and how passionless it can be, not always, but can be, and this connection she has with Jerry, and I'm thinking about her whole life story, and I'm thinking about her career and her deepest desires. It makes sense why she does what she does. And maybe from an audience perspective, you can still sit in the audience and go, what in the world are these people doing? But from the actor's perspective, having done the work to consider what are her primary objectives and what does she need from the people she's in scenes with, it's easy. And I don't know if that should scare me. but I'm as someone who I've grown to really love and cherish and admire, because I've filled out a picture of her that is beyond her affair, but that she is a person, she is a human, she is a woman living in the 1970s. And so I have a great deal of empathy for this character.
Interesting. I'm curious to hear from the two directors about what you want the audience to think about, not only the character of Emma, but all of these characters as they engage in this sort of ongoing perpetual act of betrayal. I mean, or do you even think about what you want the audience to think about all of this, or are you just leaving it up to them?
Yeah, I think, you know, we leave it up to them, but in exploring the work and preparing to direct the show, we tried to focus on what the core action of the play is, as, you know, something we work on in class, and that directors work with. Some may use similar language, but maybe phrased a little differently. But Caitlin and I each came up with something that I thought fit really well together, and we're looking at characters who are missing something in their lives, and there's some emptiness inside of them, and they're looking for this. And I used the old adage of, you know, which is really a warning, you know, the grass is always greener on the other side of the fence, but we know it's not. It doesn't stop these characters, though, from pursuing something that would be better. And I think one of the interesting things that we learn about the play, though, is that in the affair, Emma's character thinks she has found something that is better and is maybe willing to make that change, but her partner Jerry can't step away from his life. And so I don't want to say too much else, but there's, you know, there's always ramifications for the choices that we make. And I think they were both talking, Caitlin and Natalie, that, you know, this is really a relationship play. So we one of the things I think the audience can also take away is to see the real life dynamics that these characters are going through. And in that, as we were talking about the language before with the pauses and the silences, we get to see the actors on stage fill those. And it's like, well, what did they want to say, or why didn't they say something, or what were they stopping themselves from saying? And that, I think, has been the most interesting work to explore and to watch, because they're still acting, they're still communicating within the scene, even though there's no dialogue. It's all nonverbal, and some of the key moments of the play happen in the pauses or the silences where there are no words. Mm. You know, do you ever think we'll go to Venice together? And there's a pause. Mm. And then she reacts to what happens in that pause. So it's really just a great exercise to work on a piece like this.
Yeah. Caitlin Preuss, the play, if I understand correctly, is set in London and Venice. Is that where your production puts it? And if so, how does your production indicate those two settings, if it does?
Yes, our production does take place in London and Venice. The text of the play is completely central to those locations, so that was where it was going to be, and that adds in our ever-loved dialects that are used throughout the production by our actors. So, you know, we have a set that only the furniture moves. The set itself is not a unit that comes on and off or moves or anything like that. And then we've really, our lighting designer has utilized lighting a lot to indicate where we are in London. So, you know, parts of the stage represent the different places where they are. So there's Robert and Emma's house, Jerry's house, there's a restaurant, there's a pub, there's the flat that Emma and Jerry share, and then, of course, there's Venice. And there is only one scene that does actually take place in Venice. So for that scene, we bring on a new furniture piece, which I think is kind of the key indicator that we are somewhere else now. Mm. And, you know, I think the feedback from that has been great. I haven't run into anybody who saw the show who couldn't quite, you know, understand where we were. It's really, really well painted in the text. So yeah, but the dialects are the number one thing that really make the location come to life. And our actors and our dialect coach, Professor Martin McClendon, have done a really wonderful job of getting that, like, quite literally perfect. I mean, you know, even still sometimes there are dialect notes and the next day it's like, it's done, it's fixed. Mm. So I personally, as a person who's also studying acting, have been super impressed with our actors about how much commitment and how much knowledge that's taken to really get that right. Because I had friends who came to see the show and they were like, I wouldn't have known, honestly, if this was not Carthage and I didn't know these people. Like, those dialects were on par, exactly. Wow. How, you know, we as Americans think British people would sound.
Right. Natalie, what kind of a challenge has that been? And What is the challenge also in terms of folding in a dialect that is other than your own into your acting? I mean, how does that, in a sense, affect the process of you becoming the character of Emma?
It helps the process, I think, a great deal, specifically because this show is so British, and these characters are so British, and having the dialect, having that voice goes, this is Emma. This is Emma's voice. So in a sense that helping me become the character, it's very helpful. And I think actually the way all of us approached it in the show is just doing a lot of listening. I remember over the summer, I listened to a lot of the BBC just to get that in my ear. But I mean, we sort of just picked it up. We just sort of listened to it. We would listen to it. And with our dialect coach, we just really worked on getting those really specific sounds. There were really a couple that are so different from the way we speak here in the US, and really nailing down those key sounds, everything just sort of started flowing together. To the point where now off stage, when we're not in rehearsal in this production, it's sometimes easy to slip into, you know, a British dialect when you're having coffee, because it's in my body now. But it's been very helpful in attacking this character.
Very good. Caitlin earlier, Professor Kruger, Caitlin earlier made mention of the audience knowing where we are. One thing we haven't yet talked about is that matter of the audience knowing when we are. That is this whole matter of the reverse chronology. Are there aspects of the production that help clarify for the audience, or is it helpful for the audience to know right at the outset about that aspect of this play? I mean, I guess another way to ask this is the audience apt to be confused at any point about what's happening when and where are we in the timeline and so on?
Yeah, well, when you first come in, we tried to put together some music that helps set it in its time period. So you're listening to that music and you're like, okay, this is the time period of the play. I mean, we also have our program and program notes, and it tells you, and it also specifically lays out every scene in the year and the season. So you could look at that. But I think the music helps set the stage for where we are, and also the tone of what's happening. And then, you know, there's certain things as you're watching that you know, there's no slipped in anachronism. So all of a sudden they don't pull out a cell phone or have a tablet. So it just keeps it grounded in that way. But it's funny when they talk about communication, you know, Casey called or whoever it was, you know, it's a call on a telephone, a landline, and you know, there's some other things. They talk about using traveler's checks, right? When's the last time you used a traveler's check? Yeah. So and I had to explain what that was for a couple people, because they were like, huh, what's a traveler's check? So there's little things that help you, but I think the music and then, you know, the program tell you that. I think the furniture also, there's a couple pieces that are very distinctive to the period, but, you know, there's so many looks that we also have nowadays with different furniture that, is that a retro look, or are we in that time period? But I think it all fits together nicely, and you know when this takes place.
Right. And we are, I think, at least what the script specifies is we're between 1968 and 1977.
Correct.
Although we start in 1977, we end up in 1968.
Correct. Yes.
I'm curious, and I'd be curious to hear from anybody on this question. Why do you think Harold Pinter chose this tool of reverse chronology to tell this particular story? And of course, I mean, he's not here for us to ask, and we're maybe just surmising what his reading might have been. Another way to ask the question, I suppose, is what function do you think it serves, or in what way does the telling of this story benefit from it being told in this unconventional fashion of reverse chronology?
I'll leave it to both of them to answer.
Yeah, I think that... So, of course, when you have, you know, the concept of an affair in your mind, there's a certain connotation that comes with that word and that idea in society. And so, you know, from the very beginning of the play, you know, you do find out that there has been an affair that's taken place, like, from the first scene. And I think that the really fascinating thing about how it's written is that, you know, as it unfolds, you come to understand why it happened significantly better than you would if it was forwards to backwards. I think that, you know, the last scene presents the beginning of the story. So if that were first, the connotation would still be there. And it's not a particularly happy story. I mean, again, Pinter writes completely human. Like, it's not... It's one of the least dramatized or romanticized stories I've ever read or worked on. So, you know, in writing it backwards, just because of how genius he is, I couldn't dissect it if I tried completely. It really shows you how this all came to be and why. And it allows you to empathize with the characters a lot more than you would if it was forwards to backwards.
Natalie, you agree?
Absolutely. I feel very similarly. I also think approaching it from the actor's perspective, working backwards is a little bit confusing, but it is so helpful because you get to really see this very linear arc, and as you move backwards, you get to let go of what has already happened. Typically in a show, you're thinking forward. You're thinking, oh, in the next scene, this happens. In the next scene, my character is moving forward throughout time and progressing. But with this show, you just get to let go of things that happen in the future. And as you move backwards, the characters, they are more hopeful because in the first scene, you see the affair is done. It is over. It's over. But as you move backwards, you get to see the joy and the life of these characters and how hopeful they are. So like Caitlin said, it's easier to empathize with them rather than going from forwards or backwards to forwards and you go, oh, see, that was a disaster. Look how poorly this ended. Mm-hmm. But working the other way, you get to see, oh, this is so sad, but oh, look at the great beauty that was here that did develop over all of these years. And I think part of that is very helped through costumes. Our costume designer, Sierra Clark, did a really great job showing the different stages of time through the costumes. And at least for Emma, her costumes get brighter and more colorful and bolder and more fun as she gets younger. And I think that helps the audience understand where these characters are at emotionally, as well as helping clue them into, oh, they're younger in this scene.
Yeah, that's a great answer, and also takes me back to the prior answer. And I hope Sierra's listening, and here's my apology. but the costumes ground us in the period as well. So how could I have missed that? I'm sorry, Sierra. She's a student designer and has done a great job, and it's been exciting. And you know, as part of the process, that we have three student designers, lighting designer, properties, and costume designers who are also working, you know, on the show and have helped bring it to life. And also your question about the storytelling, you're just saying, you know, at the end of scene one, it's all over, and the scene ends. That's the final line. So, but the play isn't all over, but what happens the rest of the way is, and in this style, it elevates all of those key moments and elevates all of, you know, the discoveries or when things were found out or the revelations, and it just makes it more exciting. And it also gives you a different lens in which you're viewing the characters, because the way you might evaluate or want to say judge them at the beginning might be very different at the end. So, because the end is the beginning, and it's very clever, and it was more unique then, and we've, you know, seen a lot more plays utilize that type of structure. But it's just a great piece to work on again. So,
We should just touch briefly on the fact that this is Natalie's senior thesis. What does that represent when a student uses a play production as their senior thesis?
Well, All of our different students from or different areas in theater, as well as across the college, have to do a capstone project or a senior thesis. So since she's a performance major, it has to be a performance thesis. And so she writes a research paper and she keeps journals. And, you know, in the end, she'll have to then defend her work in front of the faculty. But she's also performing it every night as well, and then she'll write an assessment and a learning outcomes paper as well. So there's several stages to that. How are you doing with that, Natalie?
It's fantastic.
She sent me her paper already, so I know it's good. Yeah,
it's actually I tend to approach all of the work I do as an actor very intellectually at first. So having this thesis project and having to write papers and do research is right up my alley. That's pretty much what I do anyways, whether or not it's for a school, fulfilling a school requirement. And so for me, doing the research on the time period, on the characters, on references in the script, doing the thesis helped to streamline that process, and this is the system, this is the structure of how that is, and it's scaffolded. So that was very, it was a great tool for organizing how to approach a script.
Very good. Well, we're excited at the opportunity to see the fruits of your labors and the labors of everybody else involved in this production of Harold Pinter's Betrayal. Caitlin Preuss, remind our listeners of the remaining performances that they can attend and what they do, what they should do if they want to get a ticket.
Yes, tonight at 7:30, tomorrow night at 7:30, and Saturday night at 7:30 are our final shows. And you can get tickets at carthage.edu/tickets, and you'll just find Betrayal and pick your seat. So, yeah, or you can come to the box office before the show, but I would recommend online. Yeah.
You could also call at 262-551-6661.
And that's one more way to get your tickets for Harold Pinter's Betrayal. And to come and actually sit in the seats of Wartburg Auditorium and see a play unfold before your eyes, an experience that most of us have had scant experience with over the last year and a half or so. And how good it feels to be able to experience this again. Professor Herschel Kruger is the director of this production. Caitlin Preuss, his co-director, and Natalie Lal in the role of Emma in Harold Pinter's Betrayal. I appreciate all of you being here on the morning show to talk about this really interesting play and production. Best wishes to all of you.
Thank you, Greg.
Thank you.
The time is 8:46. Here is part two of today's program here on WGTD.
I have found myself profoundly moved by a new novel by Tayari Jones. And perhaps you know her name because of her first novel, which received all kinds of acclaim, called Leaving Atlanta. That book was set in Atlanta, Georgia, against the backdrop of a number of murders which claimed the lives of young African-American children. And three youngsters living amidst that fear were the central figures in this beautifully constructed book. Her new novel is a very, very moving one as well, a very, very personal book, which personal story, I should say, which follows the life of a woman named Ariadna Jackson, who experiences something very, very sorrowful in her childhood, and it's something which marks her for many, many years after that, and at least indirectly leads her into the path of lies, which really bring her some further hurt. It's a book which is, in the best sense of the word, most meaningful sense of the word, is profoundly thought-provoking. And I'm really grateful for the opportunity to speak with Tayari Jones about her newest novel, which is published by Warner Books. Tayari Jones, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Oh, thank you for having me.
I note in your biography that you are an English professor at the University of Illinois. How do you balance your teaching and your career as a writer?
You know, I don't really try to balance it. I try to, like, integrate them, you know, because sometimes you feel like you have to choose. But what I've learned how to do is to use my teaching of writing to help me teach myself better writing.
Oh.
Yeah, and my students inspire me. When you're around people all day who are working on writing, it makes it where I think about writing even more than I normally do. So it's been terrific for me.
Very good. Is writing something which sort of ignited your passions even early on in your life?
I wanted to write when I was a very little girl. When I was about 8 years old, I wanted to write books. I used to write little stories, and I would try to get my mother to take them to her job and laminate them for me. Because for me, like, lamination was the equivalent of preparing it for the archives.
Ah, very good. Well, this second novel of yours, The Untelling, is certainly a beautiful creation. First of all, the very title, The Untelling, I think is very, very interesting and kind of speaks to the matter of deceit and dishonesty. But it's an interesting way to put it. How did you come up with the word untelling?
Well, I like it because it does speak of dishonesty, but it also speaks of how to repair those things. I mean, as a writer, I don't want to just be, you know, diagnostic and say what's wrong. I also like to think about ways that we can fix things, ways that we can make ourselves and our communities more whole. So I came to the idea of untelling because the question is, can you untell a lie? and how would you go about it? And what I came up with is that you can't necessarily untell something, but it is our moral and spiritual obligation to try and do that.
As I already touched on, what sets the story in motion for this central figure, Ariadne Jackson, is a very sad incident when she is a young girl. Is she 8 or 9 or something like
that? She's going on 10, and her family is in a terrible car accident that claims the life of her father. And the real question of this book is, how do you move forward while still honoring the memory? Because everyone in the story has an idea of the best way to heal, the best way to move forward. But Aria, she's trying to sort it all out, and I think she ultimately is the one who comes up with the best plan.
It's intriguing the way in which she is haunted by this car accident and the death of her father. I mean, the accident itself is one thing, but in some respects what haunts her even more is kind of an inadvertent mistake she makes as a child in failing to respond to her father's pleas for help. And it's not out of indifference, but just one of those quirky little things, I suppose, that a little child will do. But this really has long-term emotional ramifications for her.
Yes, she is. You know, she's frightened. She doesn't know what to do. She's not really capable when she's a girl to do what she would imagine to be the heroic thing. And everyone in the family suffers from something. And often, you know, we have secrets, this moment where we think it's the big thing we did wrong or something that you cloak and hide for so many years. And then it's when you finally confess it, people may not even think it's as important as you do. You know, it becomes a creature of your own imagination. And it's almost like your own private torturer that you carry around with you. And sometimes the healing is in the telling.
We leave, I guess it's like the prologue of the book, and then into the experience of Aria Jackson years later, living in Atlanta, her encounters with her mother and sister and good friend and her boyfriend, and eventually this misstep which she makes into deceit. I don't know that we should tell
our listeners
too much more than that. But what intrigued you, or what first brought you the idea of exploring a lie with this kind of depth? I mean, what led you to think that it would be something fertile enough to center a whole novel around?
Well, you know, I grew up in Atlanta, and Atlanta is a story that's built on myths. And I tried to touch on that in the novel, in the Untelling, that Atlanta is a place where there are a lot of stories about how we explain where we are. And I chose the neighborhood, even, that I chose, the neighborhood that is half gentrified. Everyone keeps saying, this neighborhood is on the rise, just wait and see. It's almost like a whole city in denial about the real estate in that part of the town and the way that all these people live their lives on this landscape. And so I just started kind of going from there. I know most of the time you start from characters and build out, but this time I started from setting and built in. And I think in many ways too, Atlanta is a city that is built around a tragedy. In my generation, the memory of Atlanta is always going to be shaped for me around the Atlanta child murders, the subject of my first novel. And Atlanta, in a larger way, is a city that is built around the idea that it was burned in the Civil War. So I built on like that kind of cultural and regional issue, and then took the same kinds of problems and say, how did it affect, what is the burning of Atlanta for this one family, which was this car accident, and then how do they cope? And then I came up with this idea that a lot of times people, young women who want to escape from their childhood, they get the idea that they should like marry and institute a new family, because once you're married, when people say, who's your family, you can point at your husband. And then I thought, well, what if that doesn't work? And it kind of grew from there.
Wow. I want to say too that I'm impressed with the characters that you have created here, in that it seems to me you've really towed that tricky line of making these real people, flaws and all, and yet not with so many flaws that we don't really like them and really want good things for them and genuinely feel badly when things go badly for them. The creation of those kind of characters, I think, is a really tricky thing.
Well, it's also a gamble. I mean, I did have some struggles with my publisher about it because they tell me that people like to read books where you read the character and say, that's exactly what I would do. And I just really wasn't interested in giving the reader a mirror instead of a novel. I wanted to look into the lives of people who were flawed and see how people make mistakes and also how they genuinely change their lives. And so I just tried to get close to everyone and also view all the characters with kind of a really an open mind. And like when I was writing, for example, Cynthia, the crack addict who lived a few houses down,
yes,
to think at one point Cynthia was someone's daughter. She was, you know, she's a person too, and just try to really go in there and also imagine how they might see themselves and what would their side of the story be. And just try to check your prejudices at the door, I think, is a good way to get to that humanity of all the characters.
Right. And although most of the novel focuses around kind of a cataclysmic decision which Aria Jackson makes, a moment of deceit, and then trying to deal with that, we're given lots of wonderful details in their lives which make this story feel so authentic. One of them, very early in the book, actually, when their apartment or small house is broken into, and you write so tellingly about what it is like to come home and discover that, you know, the door's been broken in and someone's been in your home, and this intense desire to feel safe again. I read that and thought that for the first time I really had some inkling of what that must feel like. And of course, for people living in certain neighborhoods, it's a very persistent sort of fear with which they live.
Yes, and also Aria's situation is also a little complicated because she and her roommate live in this neighborhood because they're trying to make a difference. They teach adult literacy, and this idea that, you know, you go into this neighborhood with the best intentions and they find themselves having the same experience with people who live there for other reasons. And they have to kind of face their privilege and what that means and their expectations. And they have to decide whether or not they want to keep living there. And I think that's the kind of dilemma for a lot of people who work nonprofit or do, you know, other kind of good works, that when you're helping, you also put yourself in harm's way. And so this is something they have to grapple with daily, their decision to help. Like, how much are you willing to risk for what you believe in?
Right. And I guess that's part of what makes this whole story and these characters seem so very, very authentic, because you give the right amount of attention to that kind of reality, and that makes this feel like it's a little slice of real life.
Well, you know, thank you, because this novel went through 3 complete drafts, very different before I got it to where it was going, where it is now. Sometimes when you write a novel, sometimes it can just die. You can work so hard on it and the novel will just die and you'll have nothing to show for it. And there was more than one occasion when I didn't know if this one was going to pull through.
Mm. Well, it pulled through, it did, and more than that. The book is beautifully done, and again called The Untelling, published by Warner Books, the author Tayari Jones. Tayari Jones, I congratulate you on this beautiful second novel. You're also the author, of course, of Leaving Atlanta. And we wish you well with all the books which you create in the future, and I thank you for joining me today on The Morning Show.
Thanks for having me.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, we commemorate the 150th anniversary to the day of the start of the Great Chicago Fire. And to do so, we're going to be replaying a conversation that was recorded and initially broadcast 25 years ago for the 125th anniversary of that tragedy. It's an interview done by my Morning Show predecessor, Bill Guy, talking with the author of the book, Smoldering City. Support for The Morning Show comes from Carthage College, where students can conduct NASA research, produce an original play, or join an in-house marketing agency as early as their freshman year. More information is available at carthage.edu. The Morning Show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. It is archived on our website, wgtd.org, and available as a podcast, A Different Morning Show, 7 days a week. Be sure that you look for The Morning Show with Greg Berg on Apple Podcasts.